to another Global Crossroads conversation with Chris Smith and the author Mo Tejani.
Global Crossroads, the book, the e-book, hopefully the Hollywood movie.
Any day now.
we're in the third part of the book, the last part, called Brain Freeze, which has four stories in it, and we're on the third of those stories, Red Dusk of Singida.
Red Dusk of Singida.
My name's Chris Smith, Shambles Guru on the interweb, and opposite me again, pleasure of talking with Mo Tejani, the author of the chapter you've just read. I'm sorry, Mo, but I'm going to go off a slight tangent. He's sitting here with a T-shirt, and on the T-shirt it says, "I think my intelligence is flawed." Is
George Bush?
Is that where that came
That's
from?
George Bush.
Really? And yeah. Did he actually quote that?
He actually said that in a press conference.
Really?
Which doesn't need any further explanation, I don't think.
Okay, let's move on. So as listeners will know, because they've read the chapter, it's... Does it all take place on the bus? I think it's nearly all on the bus, isn't it?
All of it is on the bus. It's really... all about all the things that happen on this bus ride, which is really about maybe a 8 to 10 hour bus ride from a town called Dodoma, which is a much bigger town in central Tanzania, to this very small village-like town called Singida, which is where I was born and lived for the first 2 years of my life before my whole family moved to Kampala in Uganda, and neighboring Uganda. So...
And from what I read, I get the impression that, of course, you left when you were two from your birthplace, but you have no memories of it.
Well, unfortunately, I have a lot of memories of it, not from the time that I was when I was 1 or 2 years old, but from the 25 years that I have spent at different occasions with my families, be it at Thanksgiving or Christmas or what have you, where this town would always come up.
Yes.
The wonderful memories of this place, the place where hyenas used to howl in the background and lions would growl in the nearby jungle, the place where all my brothers and sisters, most of my brothers and sisters grew up. You know, all these memories are so vivid in their minds, so much so that it gives me, and certainly my nephews and nieces, a very strong longing to want to go to this place. And especially for me, because I don't know anything about my birthplace. You know, so...
Do you think secondhand memories like that, because they could be called secondhand memories, couldn't they? Because
absolutely.
They're passed on.
Absolutely.
Do you think secondhand memories lose something in the translation? Or do they get...
Well, they do and they don't. They do in the sense of... There's a part in the story, without getting into too much detail, where I chastise my siblings for not bringing out all the wonderful things that I saw when I actually did show up in this town. The town is surrounded by beautiful natural scenery, a natural salt lake, beautiful huge boulders, stuff of nature that I love, which they never talked about.
Yes.
It was all about what happened in the town and the families and this and that. So I chastised them, and in that sense, second memory can lose something.
Yes, because this is actually what you're doing in the book, isn't it? It's you are recapping, you're passing on your memories. And I don't know whether I should ask you this. I get the feeling you're not embellishing, though. I get the feeling that it really is, for real.
I think it's fair to say that 95% of it is absolutely real. Mm. The other 5% that may be embellishing is more as a literary technique rather than changing the content or the facts.
Yes.
Because I see this second book, Chameleon's Tale, being the first one, as a memoir. And if you're going to be true to yourself and call it nonfiction memoir, then you have to be as true to the facts of what really happened
yes.
as best as you can. So, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it from the author's mouth. It's for real. It's not one of these made-up memoir books, and it's no ghost writers here, and it's really for real. That's nice of you to confirm that, Mo.
Certainly.
It might help listeners to let listeners know that you don't actually talk about the town itself,
Singida.
Singida. You right. don't talk about that itself. But if they wanted to know more about it, you have written about it elsewhere, haven't you? Where should they go? Yes.
Well, in the first book, Chameleon's Tale, I do talk a little bit about what I find when I go to Singida in 1997. But also, after writing that book, there is a blog online called Simmerg, S-I-M-E-R-G, where I have three stories, one of which is called Singida. And if you like, it's a follow-up to all the things that happened to me in the town of Singida when I get there. Because in this story, we really talk about the bus ride getting to Singida. But that second one, also called Singida, on the blog Simmerg, gets more into what really happened when I go to Singida, which was the total opposite of what happened on the bus, which is why it's a beautiful, wonderful contrast for me.
The bus ride actually sounded a little bit horrendous, and only horrendous from how one particular person reacted.
Absolutely. The central character, Juma, is a bus conductor, and this demi-god-like character who plays havoc on all the poor people on the bus who can barely afford to pay for the fare for this horrendous 10-hour ride is what drives me up the wall during the whole trip, when in fact my mind should be totally elated by the fact that I'm, for the first time in my life after 25 years of being away from Africa, going to my birthplace.
Yes.
So in my mind, there's this conflict going on of elation versus the terrible acts that this man commits on the bus. You know, Chris, just to give us a very small example, in Swahili, when you say, wewe, shenzi, toka hapa, that is a very clear indication that you're looking for a fight. That's a very clear indication that you're taking an old man, which we call mzee, as a sign of respect, and adding to it three or four insulting words right next to them to make it sound even more insulting. Mm-hmm. The way he talks, the way he treats passengers on the bus, the way he throws off a woman and child off the bus are all examples that bring back memories that I have very purposefully sublimated for 25 years of my life. And because they come out, the demons come out with them. The dictators that have ruled Africa since 1957, when Ghana was the first country to get its independence, it's been six decades since then. And we've had a whole host of dictators running different parts of Africa. Idi Amin, Bokassa, the genocide in Rwanda, the list goes on. And it makes me realize that this stupid, ignorant, self-appointed god of a bus conductor
yes.
is really no different than those dictators. And perhaps he gets his example of the role models from those dictators. So it becomes a little bit of a delving deeper into African colonial history as well.
I can't remember how old was the bus conductor.
He was in his 40s.
So mid-age, wasn't a really old
yes,
guy then.
Yeah, and yet he would have been old enough to have lived under the occupation of the Germans. The British did not colonize Tanzania. The British colonized Tanzania and Kenya and Uganda. Tanzania was a German protectorate, even during the Second World War, which takes on a totally different meaning then. It is only after the Second World War, when the Germans have lost, that it gets handed over to the British. So there's that complication as well. And Germans were very good at divide and rule, which is exactly what that bus conductor is doing on the bus, you know?
Mm.
So, yeah.
So I'm curious, when you were experiencing this, do you stay in the moment or did you reflect on, we have a little bus dictator here that's acting as a mini something?
Well, I start reflecting back and forth between A, what's going on in my head of what to expect in Singida. Keep in mind that Singida is the town where my father was born. Father first came to East Africa in 1920. He was a headmaster in a school. My brothers and sisters born and bred there. There's a mosque where he used to be the head priest. It is wonderful to me that I am able to trace many of those roots so many years later. But I think I reflect back and forth, Chris, not just between the moment, meaning Juma and the bus conductor and what's going on the bus, but also what has gone on in Africa over the last 3 or 4 decades, because I've been away.
Yes.
Since Uganda, Idi Amin, 1972, I have been away and I've been in a totally different world. So this coming back to Africa is not just coming back to your birthplace. It's coming back to the culture. It's coming back to the good and the bad. It's coming back to the demons like Juma. And it's also coming back to the place where generosity and hospitality was second nature to the people that I knew.
Mm.
So all those conflicting emotions are running around in my brain.
Yes,
during the story.
This isn't a long story, is it? And I'm reflecting on myself, I'm not sure whether I have a good feeling at the end of the story or a bad feeling. Now, of course, most dictatorships tend to give me a bad feeling. Although you and I, before we started this conversation, mm-hmm. I switched on the microphone,
mm-hmm.
you were telling me some light at the end of the tunnel with you know, one dictator at least a step down.
Mm. Tanzania also happens to be the same country that we're talking about in this story, happens to be the country that had one of the greatest benevolent prime ministers in African history. His name is Julius Nyerere, and he was the first African politician to ever step down voluntarily from power in the late 1980s. He was also the man responsible for translating Shakespeare into Swahili. And this was also the man that brought back the collectivized socialist system of the economy and education that used to be present before colonial powers came in. Back into practice again. Very smart man. Became a spokesman for Africa, just like Nelson Mandela, during post-prime ministership. After he stepped down from power, he became a spokesman for providing peace in many parts of Africa.
Yes.
So that's the contrast.
Yes.
Here's the president who is a benevolent man that everyone revered, and here's the model, Mr. Juma, doing exactly the opposite, as a perfect antidote to all the good things that Nyerere did.
Yeah. No, you're bringing out the ignorance in my knowledge of history. So he stepped down voluntarily. There was no sort of pressure from
Absolutely.
It. He just saw it as this is the best thing for the country.
Yes, and that I am old enough, I've done my share, you're somebody I've groomed. If he happens to be elected by all of you, fine and dandy.
Yes.
But he should be running for election like everybody else.
Yes.
He was also very instrumental, just as a side note, given that the history of the Uganda nations with Idi Amin in 1972, while that was going on in Tanzania, Nyerere's finance minister controlling the money in the whole country was an Indian man, which is a perfect contrast. Cabinet post, Indian man, made very responsible for the finances of the country, while in neighboring Kenya and Uganda, the prime ministers of those countries are throwing all the Indians out.
Hmm.
So gives you a little bit of an indication of his ability to include diversity in positions of power.
Yes. I'm curious, where were you when you wrote this story? How long ago did you write this particular story? What year?
This story was written in 2010. 2010.
That's right. Where were you when you wrote it?
I was in a wonderful little town called Mae Rim on the northern outskirts of Chiang Mai.
Oh, so is this the same place where you wrote? And you've told me, and I'm trying to think.
Yes.
Which one was it? Was it Joggers? No, you wrote another one up there as well.
The majority of the stories in this collection are written in that location.
Same location.
Yes.
You said you had some favorite quotes from the story. I keep calling them chapters. I should keep calling them stories.
Right. There's a part on the bus, given that the bus is a local bus and it's crowded and it's got chickens and goats and babies and what have you. There's a part on the bus where Juma is very frustrated and very angry and actually takes a stick and starts hitting people because the chickens are making too much noise and creating havoc.
This is the bus conductor, right?
This is the bus conductor, and he says to one of the passengers, "Take your precious chicken and get off that bus. Get off this bus. I should actually charge you more for the space used by the chicken." Now, this gives you a very good idea of Juma's perspective of greed, profit, vis-a-vis the reality where the chickens and the goats have to be the passengers as well as babies, because that's one of the only means of transport available.
Yeah.
And part of some of the other quotes I think I already mentioned in Swahili, where he uses language that you would use when you're belittling an animal that you've hated, or belittling somebody that's a small child for committing a heinous crime or something like that. It's frightening. He uses intimidation through voice, through language, and through sheer facial gestures. And intimidation always works with the poor. Intimidation also works in terms of creating fear enough where you would succumb to his wishes. I did. I succumbed to his wishes too, because I knew if I stood up and started yelling back at this man, or anybody else for that matter, we would be kicked off the bus.
It'd throw you off.
And it's the only bus that comes in once a day, going to this town where I wanted to go.
Yes.
So he has you between a rock and a hard place.
Yes.
And he utilizes that position to the maximum just to show his godlike power.
Yes.
Which is no different from what a dictator does.
Yeah, those parallels are interesting parallels to think about. I'm curious, did it smell? Must have smelt on the bus. It was hot. There's no air conditioning.
There was a smell of urine. There was a smell of sweat. There was a smell of...
Don't leave out the poor chickens.
The poor chickens. But, everyone, there is a part, again, without getting into detail, where we stop because all of us are hungry and thirsty. We haven't eaten in a while. And the bus finally does stop at a place where there's vendors that come to the windows, like they do in most countries south of the border. And an amazing thing happens. Because the vendor can only reach one passenger, a chorus of people orchestrate within themselves the situation where everybody's orders are taken by the guy next to the window, and the vendor starts feeding out all this food, passing out all this food to different passengers. No question of money. The trust is already implicitly there that the money will come. And of course, the money also passes hands to the right passenger next to the window and gets to the vendor in time before the bus takes off. It's in complete contrast with what's been going on in the rest of the bus.
With Julia. Yes.
Collectivization at play,
yes.
But by the local people. And the fact that Juma allows this to happen makes me think maybe he's not as bad as I think he is. But really, he allows it to happen because he knows there's five more hours to go. If these people are not fed, I can't succumb them with fear as well as I can when they're fed.
Interesting.
This is my perspective.
Yes.
Reader can make their own perceptions.
Why didn't he let them off the bus, though? Or were people frightened of losing their... If they're stopping by the vendors who are coming to the windows, why don't people just get off the bus and see, get the vendors' food and come back on?
Chris, this whole scenario takes place within maximum of 3 to 5 minutes.
Oh, so...
And this, for Juma to allow this to happen, it's suspect. Right. Because the rest of his actions don't coincide with that at all.
You stop for his toilet breaks, bio breaks, surely.
Are you kidding? There's no such thing as a toilet break.
Wait, it was this 11-hour journey, I think. Did you say it's an 11-hour journey?
You know, if you're quick enough when there's a stop because two or three other passengers are getting on, to run out, take a pee next to the tire of the bus, and hop back on the bus before the bus takes off.
Or before you lost your seat.
Well, that too.
Yes.
That's a given.
Yes.
You know, half of the people are standing anyway. There's a very good chance you wouldn't have the seat when you came back.
Yeah.
So it's a question of physical endurance in some ways, being on this bus ride. But, you know, that's not to say every single bus ride is like this, no, Chris? I don't want to paint a negative stereotype of Africa, because one of the greatest things that does happen to me is in the town of Singida. When I get there, I managed to find my father's house. I managed to find the mosque where he used to be a clerical priest. I also managed to find people that take us in, give us food and shelter for the next 3 days, and are really pleased that we've come back to this town. So the town itself, it's a completely different story from Juma.
Yeah, and I so want to ask you to expand on that, but I'm not going to. And dear listeners, I'm sorry about this. You're going to have to either buy a Chameleon's Tale or go to the blog.
That's right.
And read through the blog, because your face lit up when you started talking about the town. Just
and now. I don't want to give away the punchline of what happens. There's a symbolic act of rebuttal, of defiance, that happens at the end of the story.
Yes.
And we'll leave it at that for the reader to make up their own decision. Because when you're faced with terror, sometimes the best thing you can do is have a symbolic act of defiance.
Yes.
Rather than open defiance, unless you don't value your life anymore.
Yes, I think, well, I think you've already answered my next question, which will probably be my last question
okay.
in here, is that... After reading this this story, what message would and I'm only hesitating because I know you've answered part of it already.
Yeah.
But just to confirm it, what message would you hope readers would take from this story?
It's a threefold message, and I'll try and be brief. 6 decades since 1957. When the first independence of the first African country has gone by. The fact that we've had a spat of direct dictators, the fact that we have had massive drought and famine and massive economic upheaval and war and violence continuing on in the same pattern for the last 6 decades means we can't necessarily use colonialism as our scapegoat tool to say, this is why all these things are happening. Enough is enough. And 6 decades is long enough for Africa having to take some responsibility. Certain people in power in Africa needing to take responsibility for their actions. That's one of the messages that I want to bring up. And then the other message is to get people to understand that while there's a whole range of amazing generosity that pervades all through Africa, there are characters like Juma that stand in the way. And those need to be, put very bluntly, squashed. That's it. That's what I want to try and bring out.
Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
This recording is one of the Global Crossroads Conversations with Chris Smith and the author Mo Tejani.